Sit down and buckle up. It's time for the Pirate Monk Podcast.
All right, welcome to the Pirate Monk Podcast. You're just stuck with me today. Nate is traveling, but I'm not alone in this conversation. I am with Dr. Tamara Rozier. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. I'm glad to finally talk with you.
Well, let's see. What do we tell the people about you? You are the founder of the ADHD Center of West Michigan. Don't get that mistaken with the ADHD Center of East Michigan. Totally different operation.
Totally different, yes.
And you are the author of a book that I found very helpful called Your Brain's Not Broken, Strategies for Navigating Your Emotions and Life with ADHD. Now, I feel like probably most of our listeners either have ADHD or know someone who has ADHD, yeah, and probably have experienced some confusion in their own lives either way. So first, I just got to ask, give me some of your story that brought you into this work. Give us a picture of you.
Well, how about this first, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah.
Something I like to explain to people is, instead of saying, here are the symptoms of ADHD, because the symptoms are a little bit problematic.
Mm-hmm.
For many reasons, they sound like other things. They overlap. I'd like to tell you what we think happens in the brain when you have ADHD.
Okay, let's do it.
And then I'll go into my story a little bit. So when you have ADHD, your prefrontal cortex, that's the part of your brain. If you tap on your forehead, that's where your prefrontal cortex is. You have unreliable access to that. And it's really unfortunate if you're living in the modern world, because that is not where intelligence is stored. It's where your organizer is stored. Mm-hmm. It's where your mood manager is stored. It's where your short-term memory is stored.
So you're processing information, interpreting the data, coming up with the right emotions to that.
Yes.
And so neurotypical people,
right, those without ADHD,
those who are on the spectrum, those who don't deal with that, are perceiving and processing information differently
than someone
with ADHD. Just a whole different world.
Yeah. Yeah. And so here's what, remember, this is a part from IQ, right? So those of us with ADHD, we go to a different part of our brain. And I know this is review for you because you've read the book. But if you kind of cup your ear, that's where the limbic center is. And the limbic center is in charge of fight, flight, freeze. And we've added another one, appease. And so those of us with ADHD, we don't have reliable access to the prefrontal cortex. And because of how we're made, our brains are like, cool, rewire, go take that back to the limbic center. Just tell me if it's dangerous or not.
Hmm. So you're saying even if you don't acknowledge it, your brain knows it's not reliable.
Yeah.
So you're doing that instinctually.
Instinctually.
And okay, when did you realize that was happening for you?
So yeah, now back to my story. I was trained as a high school teacher. And I remember learning about this thing called, in the 1980s, because I'm super old, called ADD. That's what it was, mm-hmm, called back then. And I read it and I went, wow, I think I have this. And I remember calling my dad, and my dad's like, no, that's kind of a made up disease.
Mm.
Everyone just has it. Well, you know what I didn't know? I was living in a whole house. Both parents had ADHD. Undiagnosed, but I never grew up with anyone using their prefrontal cortex. I didn't know what it was like. I mean, I knew theoretically that mothers would pack sandwiches neatly in little bags, flip over, the little part, put them in brown paper bags with names on them. I knew that theoretically that had never been part of my existence because I had never seen a prefrontal cortex actually reliably working.
That is an insanely interesting statement. I had never lived in a world with people that had, that's amazing. But I also have to throw out that in the 80s, if you said ADD, all that meant to me was a kid's hyper.
Yep.
Nothing about the brain or the why, just they've got too much energy, give them some Ritalin and calm them down.
Yeah, it's interesting. ADHD has been talked about since the late mid 1800s by different names. So it was called different things because they're observing, hey, there's a group of people that behave and think differently. But to our advantage right now is we can see the brain. We can see the brain operate. And we know people with ADHD rely on different parts of their brain.
Well, talk to me about what that looks like when they're scanning the brain. What does that visually look like for a person with ADHD?
It means there's some dark spots. So if in the fMRI, it's a machine that you can put people in and you can see brain functions. Mm-hmm. And really, it's kind of sad research and yet uplifting at the same time. It's sad research in the fact that we have to do twice as much work to get half the result. Our brain has to work so much harder with less. Now, this is nothing to do with intellect because I worked with people. I work with incredibly intelligent people. And remember, I work with lawyers and doctors. I mean, ADHD isn't a dumb boy disease, right?
Yeah.
I work with really smart people who can't rely on their prefrontal cortex. And the reason I want to talk about it like this instead of the symptoms is it's like we're running a race and we're missing half our leg. And yet, I'll be darned. Look at us run the race. A lot of us are running well. And it might not be pretty how we run. We certainly don't have the endurance, but we're running and we're doing the work. And so it's why I want to put the spin on that, man, if you're out there listening and you have ADHD and your brain's overwhelmed, you're exhausted all the time. Yeah, you're working twice as hard for half the product. Mm-hmm. You know what? Good on you. You're a hero. You're showing up like a hero.
Well, and is it fair to say that it's a different way of thinking and what you call laser focus that it's hard to talk about this because I know this manifests itself differently in different people, even in my own life. But for some of them, they have that laser focus that actually makes them amazing at certain kinds of jobs that they might not be able to trust their prefrontal cortex, but I can trust the product of what they're trying to do because of that.
Yeah. So there's a doctor named Bill Dotson, and he writes about the ADHD nervous system is an interest-based nervous system, which means shiny objects, interesting things get our attention. And when we have people focus on what they're actually thrilled about, in those times, we look like geniuses. We look brilliant. And when we're not in those times, we don't look like geniuses. It's a very sad showing. And so, I didn't say this in the book, but I'm uncomfortable with ADHD being called a superpower because it comes with enough deficits. Superpowers help you, right? ADHD, I don't think, is a superpower or this detriment. It's a different way. And so something I do is I teach people, how do you use your brain? We just have to use it differently. In the book, I talk about convergent thinking versus divergent thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And research shows that ADHD people are great at divergent thinking.
Yeah, well, let's start there, because I thought that was great. I loved you putting words to that. So will you describe that, what divergent thinking is?
Yep. Divergent thinking, well, first let's say the boring component. That's convergent thinking. Convergent thinking is you search for the one right answer. Now, ADHD people can do convergent thinking. We just find it a bit boring most of the time. Sherlock Holmes does convergent thinking extraordinarily well, right? Looks at a scene of a crime, boop, 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 boop. He finds the right answer. This person killed him, right? ADHD people are incredibly good at the opposite kind of thinking, where you take one idea and you blow it up into a million pieces. And then you see how these pieces are connected. You put them in new places. You reconstruct the ideas. So we can be sitting in a meeting and go, huh, what if we did this? And if we say it at the right moment and our divergent thinking is accurate, we look like, wow, we're superstars. And people will look at us and go, how did you ever come up with that? Now, yeah. Sometimes that divergent thinking, we want to do divergent thinking for tasks that aren't really divergent.
Right.
So in the book, I talk about the woman who calls her husband at work and said, what's the password to Netflix now? He's like, why do you need it? And she said, well, I started cleaning out, and I forget exactly, I wrote the book in 21, but she's like, well, I started to do this one task, and now all my kitchen cupboards are empty out, and they're on the cabinets. And, you know, I really did just want to move this one thing, but now I have to do it all. And now I have to watch Netflix to do it. Her brain took this one thing of this small task of where is this knife and blew it up to, I should clean the whole kitchen right now. And if you are ADHD, you probably understand because you've done that before. That's using divergent thinking at the wrong time.
Well, and that... I mean, there's three pieces that seem to connect with that. One is the time management part that you talk about. People that have that divergent thinking really struggle with realistic time management. The procrastination part, which I suspect ties into the, if I know this is going to end up being that, I'm going to put it off, but there's probably other reasons as well. And then also the anxiety that comes with that, because you've just created for every topic that you diverge into two topics, and each of those splits into two topics exponentially, you're stuck with way too many thoughts to actually come to any conclusion on. That must be incredibly stressful.
It is incredibly stressful. And that is how our brains work. And so something I do as an ADHD coach is I teach people when to actually use convergent thinking, because they can. Mm-hmm. We just don't want to. And then when to lean into your divergent. Convergent thinking is exhausting for us. It's the stuff that we find mundane and tedious usually.
What does that feel like if you're being asked to have convergent thinking? And please be as divergent as you want today. This is just delightful. But
yeah, very sad. You know, one of my clients is an accountant, and he's very smart, very good with numbers. And yet he's very sad in his job right now, because he's like, you know what? I can sum up my job. I pass a big folder back and forth from me to the client to another person. And this is all I'm doing. And he finds no meaning in it because it's convergent. He's just finding numbers. And he wants to get into an area of accountant where it's forensic accounting, and it's where you actually are the detective, you're searching for things. He's like, now that sounds like fun. Well, that's a little bit more divergent because he's searching, he's putting together a picture of the numbers. It's much different then the Convergent, here's the right sum. Here are your financials.
So I'm thinking of two people that I'm close to that both have very different manifestations of their ADHD. Mm-hmm. And as you're talking about this, I'm thinking of one of them that will often start with questions that are, I find bizarre, like what's happening here? And then we'll start going into it, but I don't know where we're going. Like we're just out in the stratosphere, you know, we're floating around in outer space.
Yeah.
We're beyond. And it will take me a good 30 minutes before I go, oh, that's what we're talking about? How did those questions, like, how did that happen? And that happens all the time. And sometimes it's hard to be patient with, because I want to start with, here's the topic we're talking about. And then fine, let's go to the questions. But it always starts with stuff that I'm basically being taken into the divergent mind, and I can't handle that at all.
Go ahead. I had a friend, he recently passed away. He was the most convergent thinker I've ever known. And I'm grateful for his friendship. He was a great, great guy. But I used to have to say to him, okay, Joel, I'm closing this folder. I'm opening another folder now. And otherwise, I'd take turns. Like, he'd be like, how is this even related? We were not done talking about this. And so sometimes he'd say, okay, I need to leave the folder on the desktop, though, because I need to go back and open it with you. And like, okay. And we worked out that way of talking when we worked together.
Well, for the other person that has that kind of divergent thinking and struggles with their job, the things they have to do that are very convergent, it leads them to a lot of kind of pessimism and melancholy.
Yeah.
So what does a person like that do, especially if they can't immediately find that niche where it's for them?
Yeah. So let me go back to the limbic center of the brain. All right, I'm going to take a circuitous route, but I will land here, I promise.
Okay.
So in the limbic center, you know, first of all, we're looking for danger. Is this dangerous? Is this dangerous? Oh my goodness, this is a bear chasing me. Well, it's actually a homework assignment, but that's okay, close enough. It's a bear. And so my brain treats it like a bear chasing me. So I get the homework assignment done, right? Mm-hmm. But in another way that the limbic center acts is like this method actor going around going, what's my motivation? Mm-hmm. And we're trying to find an emotional motivation for us to do something. And so when many of us are stuck doing convergent thinking, we go to that method actor in our brain going, what's my motivation? And sometimes we come up with anger. Okay, I'm angry I have to do this assignment. And guess what? That's fuel. We'll use it. It's not great, but we do it. Or sometimes we'll come up like, well, I'm going to do this because I'm fearful. I'm fearful I'm going to lose my job. Okay, you hear the emotion motivated actions. And so what happens is we can do convergent thinking. We usually have to dig in and find an emotional reason to do it. Some of my clients, like the accountant I mentioned earlier, he's doing his job right now because he's dutiful. And like the emotion behind it, like, I want to be a dutiful man for my family. And so I'm going to do this work that I really don't want to do because of that. But do you see, it's an emotional reason.
So he needs to first capture and recognize the emotion he's having, that he's putting fuel in the tank that'll get the car to turn over, but it's going to blow up the engine if you keep putting it in there.
It's dirty fuel.
And so first that has to be recognized, and then to actually believe, okay, I somehow have the power to pick another emotion to motivate this. And that must be hard to believe.
Well, yeah, because guess what works well? I mean, it's dirty fuel, but negative emotions work really well.
Yeah, you get some good combustion. Short-lived.
Lovely metaphor. Anger, anxiety, shame, self-loathing. Oh yeah, that'll get me going. The problem is it doesn't last and it leaves wounds. I wrote the title, Your Brain's Not Broken. I wrote, this is kind of gooey for me to say, but I really wrote it as a love letter to all those clients I'll never meet, but I really wanted them to know they're okay.
Yeah.
Because when you have ADHD, you feel like a loser all the time. And maybe all the time is overstating it, but I have to tell you, I feel like a loser a lot of the time.
Does that come from the effort you feel like you have to put in to function with everybody else, or just because you feel different and you can see that and other people can't?
Let me give you an example. Monday, I was in a meeting with really good people. I'm the only ADHD person on this committee. And very high-functioning people, very smart. And I realized I mucked up something. And it was taking the team's time to kind of clean up what I mucked up. And I spent that hour just twisting that knife in my stomach like, Tamara, you mucked this up. How stupid are you? This is embarrassing. And, you know, just that self-talk. Mm-hmm. Then at the end of the meeting, one of the lovely people on this committee said, hey, guys, I want to share this article with you. That's in the New York Times. And he was just delightful. And he's like, all right, here's the 6 top books on ADHD. And he's like, here's number 1. And then he turned to number 2. And my book was number 2. And I'm telling you that, not to brag, but just the boomerang moment of my brain going, how can these both be true? How can I be the biggest idiot on earth and get mentioned in the New York Times? And I'm going to tell you, it took everything in my brain not to go, oh, I know the answer. It's because I'm a fraud. That's it. Do you see how like the ADHD brain kind of wants to hit to the negative? And I'm not happy sharing this story, but I'm doing it in hopes that people understand. If you know someone with ADHD, we might look like we're dancing through a minefield, having a great time. Many of us are in pain. And many of us are perpetually kind of mad at ourselves when we screw up.
Are there words that neurotypical people can use that help encourage a person who's in a negative loop to start to see their way out of it?
Great question. So here's what you don't do. You don't start arguing. I see parents do this with children all the time. The kid will go, I'm stupid. And by the way, the kid is believing he's stupid. I mean, I just confessed, you know, I'm old. I know this stuff, and I was still falling into the, Tamara, you're stupid, right? It doesn't help if a parent goes, no, Johnny, you're not stupid, you're brilliant, because now I have to dig in deeper to prove my belief. So it's never helpful to argue with. It's more helpful to come alongside of and go, oh, Johnny, I'm so sorry you're seeing yourself like that. That's not accurate at all. You're hearing the emotion behind it, and you're hearing the frustration. I'm mad at my brain. My brain's not doing what I want it to do.
So really just instead of going with that convergent thinking where it's like, let me take this apart piece by piece, because I'm just seeing how that's kind of that would be my default. Let me explain to you why it's not true. But all I'm doing is asking them to do painful type of thinking at a moment that they're the least able to do it because they're in shame and negativity. So what I can offer is what I see of them, the truth that I see of them, and then just let it be.
First acknowledge the emotion. I'm sorry, you are frustrated. And that's fair. And acknowledge the emotion, because the emotions rule, really true for them. Mm-hmm. They're frustrated. They're mad at themselves. They know they could be doing better. That's a slippery slope to talk about it, but they expect higher. Mm-hmm. So they're frustrated. So having someone see that emotion, go, I see you. And then to say, it makes me sad because that's not what I see at all. In other words, we're just holding up a mirror going, someday I hope you can see it differently. I'll keep treating you like I can see it differently.
And the idea of snap out of it is just stupid.
Absolutely stupid.
Let me, I want to touch on your monster spray, because I feel like that goes into the practicals in this a little bit with discovering your monsters and discovering your monster spray. So will you talk to us about monster spray? It was monster spray, right? I don't have the book right in front of me. And so
I'm impressed. I love it. I'm impressed that you remember that image. So, monster spray has to do with anxiety. I tell the story about this little girl and her mother came into my office, and the mom was saying, hey, listen, my daughter won't use the bathroom by herself. She won't shower by herself. She won't go to bed by herself. She's not going to be by herself at all. And so I turned to the daughter and said, what's up with that? Mm-hmm. She had these big eyes and she's like, monsters. I'm like, well, that makes a lot of sense to me. I wouldn't want to be alone either if there were monsters. And then the girl was looking at me suspiciously. But then I started talking to the mom and I said, well, it's kind of simple. You need to make some monster spray for her. And I gave her the recipe. And the mom was brilliant. And she's like, oh, like peppermint oil. And I said, yes, monsters hate the smell of peppermint oil. And she turned to her daughter and said, I use that in the basement to keep spiders away. And spiders are kind of like mini monsters in a way. And immediately the daughter was like, yeah, you guys are picking up what I'm putting down here. This is excellent. And so at the end, I just said, hey, you might have to help your brothers, your little brothers. She had toddler brothers. They're going to start to see monsters too. And you're going to have to help them. Now, the mom called me the next day and she's like, I can't believe it. It worked so well. The power of that story is that we took her feelings into consideration. We didn't say, oh, honey, there's no such thing as monsters. You don't have to worry about it. Right? We said, no, monsters are real to you. Let me help you get in charge of your monsters. Let me give you autonomy in this, in power. And that's really what we need to do with adults. Many, many adults with ADHD have anxiety. You know that divergent thinking we talked about? Mm-hmm. Well, if you take the divergent brain and add just a little bit of anxiety, you can get all the threats in the world about every action you could ever take and then be absolutely crippled not to make a decision, right?
Yeah.
Because our imagination is brilliant.
Right. So you're living in a state of catastrophizing everything. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I don't, as an adult with ADHD, I don't have anxiety as much anymore. That's because I've worked on it a lot. But every day I work with adults with out of control anxiety. Now, sometimes they hijack their anxiety to go back into that limbic center to get stuff done. And so they don't really want monster spray to take care of their anxiety because they're using it to get things done, right? They're kind of scaring themselves out of bed each morning to accomplish work. So the idea of giving someone monster spray is, how can we look at this and how can you keep your anxiety at bay? Like, what are the things you can do. And so in the book, I talk about things you can do to keep anxiety at bay. Just to be clear, I'm not talking about generalized anxiety disorder. I'm talking about the anxiety that comes with ADHD.
Yeah. So let's make this, let's create a hypothetical. Because the first thing is discovering your monsters. What is your monster? Mm-hmm. So what might, give us an adult example that they might find, oh, that's my monster.
Okay. They're everywhere. It's funny because if you just think of a thing that you're procrastinating about, likely you've made that a monster. If you're thinking about anything that frustrates you, you've made that into a monster.
Okay, let's take the frustration. Say there's something at work that is just comes up at least 3 times a week, a task, a person that I have to interact with. And so that is creating anxiety, negative feelings. So I recognize that as a monster, and by naming it, I've already made it something that can be dealt with, right? It's not in the shadows of the brain anymore. It's there.
It's there. And the idea now is, what can you do about this?
Yeah. So tell me how I make a recipe for spider spray for that thing at work that's causing me frustration.
Yeah. So we don't have time for me to go into all the details about this, but it's kind of into these steps. Like you said, you name it. And then what do I have control over here? Well, it's part of my job. This guy's going to show up and ask me these questions. I don't have control about this guy not showing up. So that's not the part I can address. So we try to figure out what is the part that you can actually address with this anxiety. And then how can you address that little part of it? So, let's say this guy in your scenario, you know, someone shows up every Wednesday, he has to see this client every Wednesday and he hates seeing this client. He starts to hate Wednesdays. Mm. His monster becomes Wednesdays, right?
And then starts taking over Tuesday night.
Exactly. Right. And so, you know, my family, my kids talk about Sunday scaries. Like they get the Sunday scaries a lot. And so even being able to name it clears up a lot of the problem. So it could be, okay, I know this guy's going to show up at 1 o'clock. How am I going to construct my morning so that I'm not running around, I'm not already in the bad mood? What are the tasks I can do at work to create this sense of balance and peace right now? And kind of slowing down and emotionally engineering your day is one way to do that.
Okay.
But in the book, I talk about Ben going to the spice aisle at the supermarket, and he gets overwhelmed in the spice aisle. His wife keeps sending him for spices, and he created this like faux in the spice aisles, right? And I bring up that example because, you know, monsters are everywhere. And if you have ADHD, you're kind of creating them frequently. It's so frequent that I have clients say to me, oh, do you ever put off a task and then you finally do it and it only takes 2 minutes? Like, yep, that was a monster.
Yeah. How does this play into both people finding themselves in addiction and people who are in addiction? So it feels like it's a door in and a thing that really keeps people feeling powerless. What's the connection?
Well, very truthfully, those of us with ADHD are more likely to find ourselves in an addiction. And that's because of how our brain is wired. We have to, again, we have to work harder to avoid addictions. Our brain, the prefrontal cortex, you know, the unreliable part, well, we actually get dopamine spikes that bring action to our prefrontal cortex. And dopamine spikes could be our addictions could give us dopamine. And so it gets very, very tricky. Someday I would love to see addiction specialist figure out if there's ADHD present first and treat the ADHD and then help individuals break the addiction cycle.
So you're saying that any substance that substance or behavior that gives me a dopamine hit is making me feel more normal because it's lighting up my prefrontal cortex. So where other people might be trying to slip away from reality by using substances or behaviors, a person with ADHD is actually trying to get into reality in sort of. Is that?
Yeah. You said that perfectly. Yes, that's what I'm saying. Now, with two things that I'm thinking of, there are sometimes people become addicted to alcohol or marijuana, and that's because their brains are moving so fast, they want a break of the brain. And so that's an example of two addictions where I want out of the crazy zoo that's in my head.
So that's a relief kind of addiction versus...
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. That's very interesting. And so that's also what I suppose keeps them in it beyond just addiction to the dopamine hits or the substance itself. Sobriety feels like I am surrendering not just the substance or behavior, I'm surrendering the thing that made me feel normal or gave me relief.
Exactly. Being sober is boring. Who wants to be boring? Right? And that's why when we understand addiction in terms of how it's related to ADHD, we would take a different approach.
And I got to think that the 12-step approach or even the Alan Carr, which is very convergent thinking. Let me lay out all the reasons. Let me put all the pegs in the right places that maybe that wouldn't connect with many divergent thinkers very deeply. If they're asking like the, give me a good reason why, that might not feel like the best path to the why.
No, if it's emotionally based. And so my heart hurts every time I talk about addiction, because especially if you're ADHD, it's a feeling of trapped. Because your brain and your body are working against you, and it's a hard place to be. I'm not pushing medication. I want to be very clear to everyone, but in cases of addiction, treating the ADHD with medication is often a good step, because you're starting to regulate the prefrontal cortex performance, and then you're not seeking the dopamine in the same way. And so,
which is ironic, because if you get into recovery, many recovery folks are like, no, you can't have any medication for that. That's just you putting a Band-Aid over the thing.
I know. And it really bothers me. I want to say here, I'm not an addiction specialist, but I know the research on ADHD. And I know that when we treat ADHD, addiction symptoms subside. And so the idea of let's try, it's a Band-Aid or it's not accurate. And it's not helpful.
So when do you feel like, and I don't know, is Adderall the best medication for ADHD, or are there other ones?
You really want to work with a doctor here.
Yes, we are not prescribing anything, listeners, to anyone in particular.
Adderall isn't my favorite to recommend to people. If I were working suggesting anything, I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV. But I tend to recommend stimulants that are long acting. They're more difficult to abuse, and it gives kind of the steady, it has time release, and they've gotten very sophisticated in how they time release. So that's usually what I recommend. Stimulants tend to work for 80% of my population. And having, like, being able to take a pill, there's a one pill you could take at night. It stays in your system. And then you wake up in the morning medicated, which if your listeners wear glasses, it's like waking up with your glasses on. It's delightful. I can do divergent and convergent. It's a delightful feeling.
So who, generally speaking, obviously we're talking a lot of generalities right now, but
right.
Generally speaking, what types of folks have you worked with that you recommend? Yeah, you should take, try this out. Let's check this out versus people that you feel like, no, you don't, you have ADHD, but you don't need medicine.
Yeah. So ADHD is very sensitive to its environment, which means the more complex our environment, the more I may need support. And so if you're making it through school, you're not working that hard, and you're turning stuff in, you probably don't need anything for your medication. Mm-hmm. But if you are at University of Michigan and you expect like 7 hours of convergent thinking out of you, and you that's your goal and that's what you want, well, your brain chemistry needs help to get there. Mm-hmm. Something I say to people is, you know, if you needed glasses, I wouldn't shame you for wearing glasses. You need glasses to get through the world. And if you only need reading glasses, that's fine. Only use them for reading because the environment is saying, hey, I would like to read this up close. It's the same with medication. Medication helps us perform better. And for some of us, it levels the playing field. Remember I said we have to work twice as hard for half the result? It levels the playing field.
So listeners, I want to loop back to the beginning before we move on. You had mentioned that with addiction, this is dealing with a very emotional, it's an emotional thing. For neurotypical people, it's emotional at its core for you as well. Both from things that happened in your past and what we always come back to, that yes. Addiction is the opposite of connection, that we're looking for intimacy. But I think I'm filtering everything you're saying through, okay, I'm understanding it, but I have no idea, because you're talking about a person who sees and experiences the world differently than me. And so simply making connections between, well, it's emotional for all of us. I'm now not even playing the game anymore because I'm trying to figure out how to connect two things that are not like each other instead of trying to understand how is it different? What is that experience for this other person? Right. Which brings me to, I want to talk about understanding ADHD within the context of a marriage where one spouse has ADHD, the other doesn't, and for parents to set their kids up for the most success if they have ADHD. So let's start with spouses.
Yeah. Well, I just finished my book called You, Me, and Our ADHD Family. So great timing on that question.
Nice. When is that coming out?
September.
Okay.
With Revell. And so first we have to understand ADHD is hereditary. So if a dad has ADHD, according to Barclay, he is 70 to 80% likely to pass that on to his children.
Wow. That's a huge number.
I know. I met an anesthesiologist one day who has ADHD, and she's absolutely brilliant. And she said, why aren't we paying more attention to that? If we get a 0.1 in medicine, all eyes are on this. Why aren't we looking at this more?
And yet, I think in the book, didn't you say 7% of the population has ADHD?
Is Yeah, it's so predictive.
So that's, this is staying in the family bloodlines.
Exactly. Exactly. I didn't know there were people who did things in a neurotypical fashion because I wasn't around that.
Well, before you keep going with the family, does that number include, because it's only been the last few years, I didn't realize that people on the spectrum, that ADHD is just kind of like a companion piece to most people on the spectrum. So does that include them, or is it just, oh no, they're just on the spectrum, and so we don't really count them as ADHD people? I don't
think it includes them. I'm just going to be honest, it's a sloppy number. Mm-hmm. It's the best number we can find right now. It's a sloppy number. We have a saying at the ADHD Center, ADHD always travels with friends. So it's very common to have ADHD and a learning disability, ADHD and autism, ADHD and OCD. Like, mm-hmm. ADHD likes a friend. And that's a very common thing that we see. Now, there are some people who only have ADHD, but as we become more sophisticated and understanding, we're seeing a lot of friends traveling with ADHD.
Okay, well, back to the family. Now through the father. So usually you're talking about, you're going to have multiple people in a family.
Yep. Moms pass it on too, just at a lower rate, between 60 and 70% likelihood. So, so now we have a family. We have a family of haves and have nots. We have a family who thinks emotionally motivated and a family who relies on convergent thinking, right? Now, if you think about it, this is a recipe for disaster, right? Because now you have people not understanding each other. And a common thing that I see in marriages is you have one spouse who keeps forgetting to do things and doesn't look like they're being a grown-up and, you know, all the ADHD symptoms that people are familiar with. And then the spouse starts to act like a parent their significant other. And that's something I see very commonly. In the home, you start to see all the ADHD people kind of go, all right, clearly we're alike in some way. Let's try to, you know, outsmart these neurotypicals. But then they'll start infighting because ADHD people have big emotions. And so you see how complex being in an ADHD family is. And remember, this is ADHD's not new, right? I can trace my ADHD at least back to my great-grandfather. Because you can kind of see through behaviors. Mm-hmm. It's just that society was different back then. And you can't drop out when you're in sixth grade and work in a copper mine.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely have the emotional motivation of, I'm going to be screwed if I don't show up and work in the mine. Okay, we talked about the convergent and divergent thinking, and I see how that comes into play, but you've said a couple times this emotional thinking. And I think, what was that, chapter 2 or 3, where you talked about that base where where decisions are made. Can you explain a little bit more for the neurotypical crowd, what you talked about in the book concerning that being the core place that emotions are, or the decisions are made from?
Yeah. So that's also going back to Bill Dodson said, we have a nervous system that mm-hmm. is emotion-based, is interest-based. And so when you can't rely on your prefrontal cortex all the time, your limbic center goes, okay, I need to know, is this dangerous? If it's dangerous, I'm going to respond with an emotion. And I'm not assessing danger as logical. I'm assessing danger through emotion. So it's a raw way of responding. And it's not fully engaging the prefrontal cortex for a while.
So Yeah, what? I'm trying to remember. It was very interesting how you talked about it with some of the questions that an ADHD brain will ask first that were different than neurotypical. And they were more the emotions, and it was just a great way to describe it as different. See, now I'm like,
okay. Are you talking about the butler versus the angry neighbor?
I might be. Okay. Go with that.
Let's pretend that's what you were thinking of. Okay. Yeah, if it were. The metaphor that I use, and I just did a podcast with someone from England, and he asked about this. And so he did the accent of the butler perfectly. But for those of you who are neurotypical, imagine that you have a butler in your brain. And your butler says, "Sir, you left your keys on the corner of this table. It's time to leave now. Do you want to leave?" Now, more of a modern adaptation would be like you have Siri in your brain reminding you. But I like the old school butler. And so it's a very calm way of going through life. And by the way, I noticed I have ADHD, and I noticed there are people around me who just knew when it was time to leave. They just knew. And I started noticing this as young as third grade. And a lot of us realize we don't really have that butler available to us around third grade. And so the butler's like, "Oh, this is a lot to organize. Let me organize this for you." Or the butler says, "Wow, this is a lot for you to remember right now. Let me give you a bag to put," and we'll call that short-term memory or working memory right now. "Just put it in this bag right now." And so this butler is delightful in helping you. So those of us with ADHD, we don't have the reliable, calm butler. Instead, we have this angry neighbor. And we hear him screaming at us, shaking his shoe, disheveled-looking curmudgeon, going, "I'm telling you, if you don't find your keys right now, why, I'm going to throw this at you. You're no good for nothing, whatever, whatever."
Yeah.
And that's kind of how an ADHD person experiences looking for keys.
So for a neurotypical person, they'd be like, "Well, I feel emotional about things too." That's what you mean by heightened emotion, is that they've got that voice in their head. And so I'm thinking both with children and spouses, that when it's confusing, like, why are you doing it this way? We're never going to get done what needs to be done, or those kinds of things, that understanding first, okay, their brain is working differently than me, and they might have a curmudgeon yelling at them right now. Yeah. And so they might be doing nothing because they're hiding from the curmudgeon.
Oh, I love that you added that. Yes. I hide from my curmudgeon all the time. He's mean.
Yeah.
And he's throwing shoes at me.
So if they're still sitting there playing a video game when you have to leave in 2 minutes and they haven't put their shoes on yet, that doesn't mean they're not feeling emotion. It might be that they're feeling way too much emotion. And they're like, "If the second I turn this off, who knows what's going
to
happen?
I don't want to have to do this transition." By the way, a lot of ADHD people aren't great at transitions. It takes emotional energy for transitions. So let me give you an example of big emotions. Those of us with ADHD have big emotions. So on a number scale between 1 and 10, okay, 10 is intense emotion, big, big, big. Okay, it's not good or bad emotion, it's just intense. And 1 is meh, whatever. Neurotypical people on a daily basis operate on a 4, 5, or 6. Boop, boop, boop. You're just right in that nice little area. If you're ADHD, you operate between the 8 to 10 and the 1 to 3. We don't usually have it's just fine. I'm just right in the middle of the emotions. Not too much, not too little. We don't have enough emotion sometimes, or we have too much other times.
Do ADHD folks get misdiagnosed as being bipolar because of that?
Yes, very frequently. And again, now we can see the brain and we can see how this is happening in our brain.
And this is different than what you would see with a bipolar brain.
Yeah. Bipolar. So for those of us with ADHD, it happens intensely, immediately, and fluctuates greatly. Bipolar, there's different predictable patterns. Well, not predictable, but there's different patterns.
Right. Cyclical. I mean, it sounds like.
Cyclical was the word I was trying to say.
Yeah, yes. The time difference, the fuse for when those changes happen are very different in length.
Yes. Yes.
So we're waiting for the manic or depressive versus, yeah. Oh, I just got hit with an emotion and now I'm in that space.
Yeah. In the book, I write about a very embarrassing thing. You know, in the summer, I get in my car, it's really hot. I start sweating. I'm like, are you crazy? I hate this. I hate the feeling of being hot. And immediately, kind of my emotions go to an 8 because I'm in a car that's too warm.
Yeah.
Guess what? The car's going to cool down in just a few minutes. The beads of sweat will dry. I'm fine. And I'll go back.
Well, and I'll close with this thought. There's so much more we could talk about, but I'm being mindful of your time here. You talk about making decisions for your future self.
Yes.
That in that car, that would be an example of, even in a very short-term way of thinking, I will be cool in 5 minutes. I can deal with 5 minutes.
Exactly. In fact, that's what I say. Hey, Tam, this is going to be okay. You know this is not permanent. Just take a couple deep breaths. Let's keep moving.
Well, Dr. Tamara, how do people get your book, find out more, go deeper if they need to on this topic, because we've just scratched the surface of a whole lot of stuff. How do they get into your world?
Yeah. So if you've heard anything that made you go, huh, I wonder if, you can get either of my books, anywhere books are sold. But there are so many places you can learn about ADHD. There's great organizations. One organization I love to promote is Adults with ADHD, ADDA, ADDA. Love that organization. That's a great place if you're like, I don't even know where to start with this. They love helping people figure out where to start.
That is so great. Well, we have just chewed through this time like crazy. So we're going to wrap it up. Listeners, you know that if you have any questions or comments or thoughts, dad jokes, or, you know, just want to vent, send that to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. And that's it. So, thank you for hanging with us. I'm Aaron, and you have to say your name now.
Oh, I'm Tamara.
And we are today's pals here at the Pirate Monk Podcast.
The Pirate Monk Podcast is produced by members of the Samson Society. Send your feedback or questions to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and share the podcast with a friend. For more information, please visit samsonsociety.com.